is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Ray Sawhill. We're going to be discussing journalism and culture. Ray, it's great having you back on the show.
That's great talking to you again, Robert.
And I'm also joined here with Alex von Goldstein.
It's been great talking to you guys today, and let's keep going.
Last time we talked, we touched upon briefly your career in journalism at Newsweek. With journalism at Newsweek, you covered arts, culture, film review, book reviews. Was journalism your main passion in life, or did you just kind of wind up there by accident?
I was kind of a random arts buff kid. I mean, you may have been that at 16 yourself. And I wanted to come to New York, and I needed a job because I wasn't born with a trust fund. And I just, through a series of connections, I tumbled into a very low, menial job at Newsweek, and over the years kind of rose ever so slightly at the magazine. So no, it wasn't. Arts journalism wasn't something that I consciously targeted and then labored away at.
Well, Ray, you're talking about kind of like growing up as an arts kid. And
very much, yeah.
And I think that this is an interesting thing to kind of touch on. I mean, I feel like, Robert, you may have talked to The Truth Will Live about being like an aesthete. Like, I think she called herself that on Twitter, and people have called me that in my life, because I've always been someone, like, you know, when I was a kid, I, you know, had this initial period of, like, getting into kind of more fringe, like, art and literature and music. Like,
oh, sure. It's a great time in life, isn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, the weird thing is, like, as a millennial, I just had all this media, you know, that, you know, everything was available for me. So, you know, when I was 12 years old, I could go and, like, record Deliverance off TV, like, uncut and widescreen,
or go to the library, five or ten years ahead of me. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, so that's the weird thing is, like, you know, millennials have had, like, that kind of time accelerated for them. And you know, you can use the internet and just kind of find like-minded people, and these sort of scenes can just develop. But for you, I mean, you're kind of that same kind of variety, like of that sort of hipster kind of personality.
We had to make do with the technology at the time. One of the reasons I wound up in New York was that if you were interested in edgy, far out, weird, what was happening, I mean, the stranger thoughts and the stranger work that was being done at the time, you actually had to physically track that down. You couldn't just sit down and Google it and see what was going on, or go to YouTube, anything like that. It was, I've often wondered, I mean, I'm doing my best not to turn the tables on you guys, but I'd love to know what it's like to be a younger person growing up with the web and with computers who's interested in fringe ideas and the arts. Got to be very different. You don't necessarily have to go to New York or LA.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's like you have to go to New York or LA for like the legitimacy, you know,
or legitimacy.
And I'm sure it was the same way then. I mean, the thing is, all the media is there, like, and it's easy to find, you know, even 10 years ago, like when I was in, you know, I was kind of into like weird horror movies, like when I was in high school, like I was in, like, you know, like From Beyond, like, you know, like the Lovecraft stuff, like Stuart Gordon. I mean, you know, like, sometimes, like, you had to go and, like, drive to a library, or get my mom to drive me to, like, a library so I could get, like, the VHS, because it hadn't been released on DVD. And
Mom, would you drive me so I can go see an R or X-rated film?
Yeah, and then, you know, I mean, so I think Robert and I maybe even missed the boat a little bit on just kind of, like, full digital, like, childhood, you know, because it's like there's that, like, Baudrillard idea of, like, the simulation or whatever that will eventually take over the world, and it's
society,
like,
society of the spectacle, baby.
Yeah, and, like, you know, millennials are totally wrapped up in it, and I've heard stuff about, like, super far right politics popping up on, like, Neopets forums and stuff like that. You know, it's like they're already becoming, like, crazy nationalistic children.
You guys are getting to be the age now where you're starting to be able to look behind you at people younger than you and see that they're a little different than you are. I would be very curious to hear how you find them different than you are.
Robert, do you want to start?
They're even more digital, and they have even more available than you guys had when you were young.
I mean, people who are, say, 10 years younger, they have the internet their whole life. Like, I can remember the first time I used the internet. must have been maybe, like, in fifth grade. Someone today, they didn't even, the idea of a world without the internet was unfathomable. And same with social media. I remember when social media became big. It was back then. It was MySpace around the time. It was around like my senior year of high school. Today, like people grew up with social media, so they can't imagine a world without it.
And that's so funny. I imagine people growing. Probably young people today have no memory of MySpace, which is so funny to think about.
Yeah, certainly.
It's Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. I suppose they've all left Facebook at this point.
And it's weird because with the internet, you have access to just about anything. But even with all that, you would think it would be creating all this amazing innovation with all the information that's out there. But it's still kind of the same thing where it's like a very small group of people who are really creating like most of the innovation in the arts.
Well, I think with that is that you have, you know, we all have the ability to get online, so we're basically in like the panopticon, you know, we're all sort of looking at each other. So it really just takes courage, I think, to make something kind of interesting or have an interesting conversation. You know, like I've gotten into shit. I'm sure we've all sort of had our kind of backlashes against us for speaking kind of in a way that's not of the status quo.
And I also hear both critiques of the internet. One argument is that the internet enables nonconformist and innovative thinkers to connect with each other and come up with new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've also heard the critique that social media and the internet foments sort of a more extreme conformity and a overall kind of stagnation of a culture. And I think both of those arguments are valid in different ways.
I was about to say, yeah, both of those things may be true. There's a funny, I mean, if I can play, I guess I have no choice but to play the old guy in this conversation. There was a funny moment, I forget when it was, like in the late 90s or something, after internet connections had finally become a little faster than they were initially, so you didn't have to spend hours waiting for something to download. And I remember this funny sensation I had where I had an interest in something, and I wish I could remember what it was. I explored it on the internet, and I got to the point where I had learned everything about it that I wanted to learn. I had never had that sensation in my life before at all.
But you get to the point where you like would consume this thing entirely?
I had exhausted my interest.
Sure, yeah. Like, I mean, for me, like, you know, before I got into this sort of you know, I guess cultural, political kind of thinking. I was just purely, like, you know, artistically minded. Just, you know, watching movies and playing music and sort of just living in that world, and that was it, you know. And the thing is, I kind of feel like I exhausted it.
That like, can happen. And, you know, in the old days, and boy, am I sensing my gray hair when I say this, but in the old days, you could never exhaust your interest. It just wasn't a possibility.
Yeah, I think that
physically there was something you couldn't get to. But these days, you discover that your interest in something which feels infinite, you know, in the old corny way of, I'm so hungry I could eat a horse, and then you have some coleslaw and a hamburger, and you're fine. You know, you don't really need to eat a horse. But if you're information-wise, culturally, if you're a little starved, you can feel like you need to eat a horse. But then if you actually find out something, you go, that's it. You know, that's the extent of my interest. I'm fine now. I can move on to another topic.
And I think that never happened before.
When you were working as a journalist for Newsweek, were you constantly like discovering like these new artists and filmmakers, and were each of them – like the minute you discovered a new artist, was it very exciting? Or over time you just sort of said, oh, he's another artist, whatever.
You do get a little jaded. I mean, that's part of the fun. People in New York City at that time, and particularly people in cultural journalism, you got to be very cynical and flip about a lot of things. And yet they would still reach you and they'd still move you. You tried to remain fresh. You tried to discover things. the difficulty for me was that a lot of the stuff that I encountered that I thought was really cool and groovy and fresh and new, all those things, I just couldn't persuade my bosses to cover. So that was very frustrating. And that's one of the reasons why in the early 2000s, when blogging technology came along, I started blogging. I just had to share some of the stuff, I'd found out about the world.
Right, for this blog at Two Blowhards.
I used to write for a blog called Two Blowhards. I currently write for a blog called uncouthreflections.com. And I've got a bunch of very brilliant, very wonderful, very irreverent co-bloggers at Uncouth Reflections. But Two Blowhards, no, that had a good 7-year run.
So what's interesting about that blog, kind of what you were getting at, is kind of appealing to a lot of these different people who have interesting cultural ideas, but it wasn't. But what's interesting about it is that this was totally not a political blog. It was just about getting people together who had interesting cultural ideas.
That's a really good way of characterizing it. One of the things that drove me to start blogging in 2002 was that it's possible. At that point, for some reason, a kind of proto version of political correctness had come along, and you absolutely could not be somebody who was interested in culture without subscribing to a checklist of 20 things. You had to be a feminist, you had to be an environmentalist, you had to, you know, agree with all this crapola circa 2001, 2000. And I was sitting there going, well, you know, I'm interested in culture, but I can't sign off on this checklist. So how do we make sense of this? So I said, I'm going to take this public. I'm just going. There were 7 or 8 different reasons why I started blogging, but that was certainly one of them, just to assert that you could be a culture guy or a culture girl without subscribing to the whole NPR, PBS, New York Times version of culture. You might see it very differently and still be into architecture, still be into music, still be into literature. That was a big part of what I was asserting with Two Blowhards. And it was very interesting how quickly the blog caught on. It took about a year, and suddenly we were getting thousands of readers every day.
Do a lot of people get into art journalism, people who are artists and writers themselves, because it's difficult to make a living as an artist or a writer?
Well, in the day, yes. I mean, I not to be too tedious, but I'm talking really about the 80s and 90s. I backed out of it in the early 2000s, and I have no idea what it is to be a magazine writer today, for instance, or what it is to cover culture today.
I know Steve Saylor.
But absolutely, yeah, back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, no, you had to pay the bills somehow. You're a creative person. Chances were extremely good. You weren't making a living from your creative work. You had to figure out some way to pay the bills. And of course, living was cheaper in those days. So maybe you were an arts journalist. Maybe you were a critic. Maybe you were a teacher.
Well, the thing is, you know, you're saying you went onto the web around like 2000, like the early 2000s, right?
Well, I went on the web considerably earlier than that.
Well, like you're blogging. Your blogging
job,
I mean,
was that I tuned into the internet and the digital world a lot earlier than a lot of the people I worked with did. It was enormously frustrating to me to try to stress to them how the world was changing. In 1995, an awful lot of serious, intelligent people in the conventional media did not take computers terribly seriously. They didn't take the web terribly seriously. They couldn't see that it was changing the world in a very fundamental way. I was lucky enough at the time, because I was out there prowling around looking for interesting stories, to have bumped into a lot of very interesting, intelligent people in those worlds. And it clicked for me. I got it very quickly. I could see that, oh my God, this is really serious. This is, you know, the birth of print all over again. It's the beginning of television all over again. It's major. And I just could not get my bosses to understand that.
Yeah, back then, journalism was very something. It was limited to a small group of people. And
it was the era of the gatekeeper.
Exactly. Now, anyone can go online and say, look, I'm a journalist. And there's kind of, it's kind of that debate about elitism, and there's like pros and cons of it. One, now that everyone can get their ideas out there, you're exposed to a lot of a great and interesting, innovative ideas that would have been suppressed in the past.
Oh, for sure.
But
yeah.
The other side of it is now anyone can speak their mind. You have the social media culture where you kind of have to get past all the crap. So there's...
Oh my God, most people are really stupid.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's sort of like they just come out of the, you know, invasion of the body snatchers pods, you know.
For sure. Yeah, that's really funny.
So you kind of got involved, you left journalism sort of at the very, like, tail end of print journalism and beginning of online journalism. I know you also wrote for Salon and Huffington Post.
I wrote for Salon. I never wrote for Huffington Post, but yeah, and I was linked to fairly early on. Do you guys remember Arts and Letters Daily?
Oh, yes.
Arts and Letters Daily was a great, great website that really, really shook up even the traditional world of cultural journalism. There was a guy named Dennis Dutton behind it, and Dennis...
Oh, it was Dutton Books.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Dennis in L.A., yeah, from a great bookstore family in L.A., Dennis did a kind of best of the web from a cultural philosophical point of view early on, and he really shook up a lot of people. He was, over time, I mean, he was this philosophy professor in New Zealand, and over time, he shook people up so much, he got such a response. He was doing things that were so different to what, say, Time Magazine or the New York Times Sunday Magazine was doing, and yet he was getting terrific excitement that he was invited to the New York Times and the Washington Post to tell them what it was he was doing that was actually stirring up interest. Anyway, very quickly, Dennis and I, in the early days of blogging, connected and got on like a house on fire. Unfortunately, Dennis came down with prostate cancer and died. He was a really good guy and a major figure in opening up the world of the cultural discussion online. There was a funny, I mean, I'm going to be very long-winded, if you'll forgive me. There was an interesting moment in the early 2000s, and this is part of what motivated me to blog as well. The way that culture was discussed was, to my mind and to Dennis's mind and to the mind of many other people, was offensive. It was highly controlled. It was gatekeeperish. There were people who we supposedly entrusted to make decisions about what we should pay attention to, how we should think. And it struck me that this was just, you know, way too 1950. This is absurd. It's crazy. Things should be a lot more open than they are. And people like Dennis Dutton and I at my little website, twoblowhards.com, which is still out there on the web, we wanted to do something newer, fresher, more open, more responsive, less of a lecture, you know, the great intellectual lecturing the passive audience, and more of a conversation, just stimulating things, getting into things, opening things up. And that's a big part of what actually drove me to get into blogging in the first place. It was a big part of how I thought that the cultural conversation should go and should change and should evolve. So I pat myself on the back when I'm in a mood to do that for helping push that door open. Of course, these days, yeah, everybody's got an opinion and everybody can publish because everybody's got a computer and can go on Twitter. So well, it's all buried in the past. The year 2000 or 2002 is a really radical act.
Well, the thing is, what I was trying to jump in before about Steve Saylor is that if you look at people who did that around that time, you know, it's like Steve Saylor or Jim Goad is another person.
Razib Khan,
exactly,
sure.
Or even our friend here, Luke Ford. You know, you know, it was sort of the more, you know, and look at where they are now, you know, and what they're talking about now. And it seems like it's the more risk-taking, ambitious ones among us who kind of like sort of feel the zeitgeist and can go with it.
You're absolutely right. And these were people who in the old world, in the world of gatekeepers and traditional media, they could not get their voices published. They could not get heard. So I think, like me, I mean, in my small way, I think they were eager to say, you know, I can publish. I can do it on my own. I can get out there. People can discover me. People can find my ideas. There was just amazing ferment. I'll never do it, but I've had a fantasy about making a documentary movie where I would go and interview Razib Khan or Steve Saylor or some of these early bloggers. There were people who were doing tremendous things that had never been seen before.
Razib Khan, I know he started out writing for the New York Times, and I think he got fired from there.
He got fired.
Razib actually started out at GNXP.com, which was an evolutionary biology website where he blogged with five or six other people. There was a big cast of characters that went over time. Razib was really the mastermind behind it. And he's continued. You know, he's still out there blogging. He's at unz.com these days.
We've had Ron Unz on our show.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Good for you. Well, you should get Razib on the show, too. He's very articulate.
Oh, yeah. We'll
smart.
Definitely try to contact him.
Oh, do? Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't had a lot of people that are in that kind of, like, HBD territory on. We haven't.
Oh, you should. That's huge. I mean, it's such an interesting part of the online world.
Yeah.
I can put you in touch with Razib if you want.
Sure. I mean, the thing about HBD is people sort of use it, you know, studying, like, you know, if you read something like Henry Harpending, it's just fascinating literature.
Oh, and Cochrane and Harpending are so good, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and then it's, you know, but people sort of see it as something that's like a horrible thing. Or at least people in my generation, it's so difficult for them to process these things, which I don't think are bad. You know, like, I think these things are there's nothing. You know, you can talk about these things in an incredibly sensible way. But,
well, I would love to hear from the two of you guys. Are you? Do you feel you're of the generation of the SJWs or not?
I recently realized a culture that I was a part of when I was younger is sort of like very rooted in like probably Antifa types, you know, these like punk
oh,
people.
Oh, really? Oh,
well,
wow.
Because, you know, like when I would go to, you know, New Brunswick, New Jersey and go to like noise shows because I was into that kind of, you know, like super.
Because
like,
you were that type.
Oh, no, that's definitely like the stuff I, you know, would go and check
oh,
out.
Sure, yeah.
And that's you know, you were saying to Robert, in the last interview we did with him, that, you know, you're into this kind of, like, abstract art and stuff like that. Like, there's, you know, you can think analytically and like abstract art, you know, some people just sort of say it's trash.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I do really, I think there's something really, really interesting about, you know, just, like, noise music. And I don't really listen to it as much as I used to. You know, there's some people like Jim O'Rourke, who's a Chicago guy who lives in Japan now, or Oren Mbachi, I think is his name. It's an Australian guy who
mm-hmm.
I can go on about this kind of stuff, but there was something about this music that kind of like took me out of the world, you know. And I feel like people that are into that kind of music can kind of transfer themselves to this kind of thinking a bit easier, because
mm-hmm.
you know, you're just sitting there appreciating this really strange thing. I mean, unless someone's just a total dilettante and like just pretending.
I'd love to know how you guys explain the rigidity and the fanaticism of the SJWs
well,
of your generation.
That's what I was saying, is that, you know, I was in that kind of crowd, and then
uh-huh.
you know, what happened was, you know, people became more and more homogenized, and then there were less and less people that actually went out to the kind of, you know, basement shows or whatever. And eventually just like normal kids would end up going. And then I would have to go, and then the stupid like punk kids would end up being there as well. And then we'd all,
yeah.
we sort of merged into like one group of this kind of like implicit American, kind, you know, like old American, like William Lind would say or whatever, of like that kind of like world, like, you know, baby
oh, well,
boomer
hold on
kids.
A sec. I'm having an old fart moment. Come on. Let me share it with you. I have a friend here in Santa Barbara who works me out, who does this amazing thing called resistance stretching. He's great. Anyway, I was gabbing. He's 28. I was gabbing with him, and he told me he grew up and I guess spent his teen years as what he called a punk rocker. And as someone who was in New York in the punk rock years, I was there, you know, starting in 1978, I found myself thinking, punk rocker, really? I thought that was like 1978 or 1980. You know, it's amazing to me that there still is something called punk rock, and that there still is something called punk rockers.
I'm sure that like the punk rock though of your time is very different than of mine. Like that probably, you know, if there's some kind of like evolution of scenes, like what you were a part of, I think became something different than like what's currently this kind of punk stuff, because it's all rooted in that kind of like totalitarian humanism, you know?
Oh, is it really? I have no idea what punk rock today means.
Are you familiar with Keith Preston, the anarchist?
Sure. Yeah. He's a great blogger. He's
yeah.
a great guy. I love
Keith. Is awesome. But,
he
you know,
is, yeah.
he had listened to something that I did on, you know, Robert and I's show, and basically said to me, like, you know, my experience was very similar to yours. Like
mm-hmm.
I was completely in this kind of like ultra left wing kind of like, you know, punk sort of scene.
Sure, yeah.
And basically was like, wait a second, like, I'm against the system. These people aren't against the system.
No, these people are
the enforcers of the system.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're just drawing out of me all kinds of old fart reactions, but it really is funny. As time passes, things change and definitions change. My point of view has never really changed much since about 1975, but in 1975, my particular point of view was thought of as like absurdly, headbangingly beyond left-wing. These days, the exact same point of view is viewed as headbangingly right-wing. It's extremely strange to experience.
So the two sides, in a sense, they kind of switched roles. So originally,
yeah, it's a little hard to know when that happened, but it did. And the you know, punk rock, what does that mean? It's punk rock in 1980. Small historical tedious note: a lot of punk rockers thought that they were burning down the house. Pop music had cropped up in the 1950s with Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry. And in 1980, we thought we were ending it. We thought we were calling an end to it. It was over. You know, it had reached its decadent phase, and we were now burning down the whole edifice. And what a shock to discover in 1985 that pop music was still going on, and that punk rock, like the hippie or various other archetypes, had become a kind of standard character in the general culture.
So, right,
and these days, there are still people who are punk rockers.
Do you know? But yeah. See, that's the thing. I view this at, well, do you know the Derek Jarman film Jubilee?
I never saw Jubilee, but I've seen some Derek Jarman. Sure,
Robert, have you seen Jubilee? Have you?
No.
Well, the thing is, it's like a punk rock movie. And, you know, it's like Situationist era, like, you know, maybe like a band like a little bit before like Wire or something. Adam Ant's in it, you know, before
he was, that's hilarious. Before yeah, that
he was,
when
he was a little more like punk, though. And, you know, when I watch this movie, I kind of understand what you're talking about, because it was really about like destroying the kind of like fake media culture. Like, that's what punk rock seems to represent.
Society of the spectacle, baby.
Yeah, exactly. And what punk rock sort of has become is just a part of the kind of, you know, simulated mainstream thing that everyone sort of is. It's become an archetype.
I think even among these sort of SJW types, I think there's sort of two types. I think there's one who are really deluded, and they see themselves as actually fighting against the system and, like, the power structure.
Yeah.
And some of them, basically, they're just going along with it to conform to the power structure. So I think there's, like, two mindsets among those types.
There was a great meme, which was, I forget how it was phrased. It was phrased very cleverly. It was mocking SJW, saying, you know, you're going out there and you're basically enacting what your teachers tell you to enact. And you're deluding yourselves because you're thinking you're fighting the system, but your teachers are part of the system.
Well, you wrote for a salon. And
I did, yeah.
Salon is considered like the main SJW website.
Chuck Johnson.
That's disgraceful, yeah.
Chuck Johnson said he thinks it's a Koch brothers scheme. Like, to make people become like neocons. Like, you go on Salon and it's like, having sex with dolphins is good. And you're like, you know, what the hell is this? I want to become a conservative now. I want to conserve my current value system. So you
have a punk rock, anarchist, situationist background, which it sounds like you guys do, and I certainly did, even at the time, and to wake up in this era and find yourself being cast as the bad guy.
What was Salon like when you were involved? It wasn't always like that.
No. Early on, Salon, there was a guy named David Talbot who was the mind behind early Salon. And it was, you know, it was a left liberal kind of outlet, but it was pretty freewheeling. Talbot brought on Camille Paglia, for instance, to be a regular columnist.
You know, I think she still might write there. Even though
she still does, yeah.
She's fairly politically incorrect.
She's extremely politically incorrect, but she's also a huge star, so I'm sure she attracts a lot of readers. Well, anyway, I always had a good time interacting with my editors at Salon and with Talbot through my editors at Salon. They were curious about the larger world. They were open. I did, for instance, two interviews which attracted a tremendous amount of attention early on. One with Roger Scruton, who is a conservative Tory British philosopher, and another one with Thomas Sowell, who is very well known as a right-wing American. He's a black guy, and so he gets a lot of attention as a black Republican. And it was in a phase of my life when I was educating myself about conservatism. And to Salon's credit, they said, that's cool. You know, let's do it. That's going to bring in some interest. People are going to get angry. We'll get readers. That's terrific. Let's go with it. And so they were open. You know, they were really a lot of fun. It was very rollicking at the
Ray,
time.
Was conservatism something that your brain, like, you sort of became, like, interested in? Like, you just started reading about it, right? Because it's like, you know, when you come from this left-wing milieu, it's like, you know, conservative ideas are just – I mean, and I'm not, like, a believer in, like, you know –
They're
you know,
like pieces of shit. They are – right-wing ideas are so loathed by on the left.
Yeah.
That they're really the most loathsome, disgusting.
Sure.
I can't bear to look at that. I can't even, you know, the idea of handling it and tasting
it
and actually considering it is so disgusting to me that I can't go there. And so I had to, like, go there, of course.
This is kind of back to what I said earlier. I think there's two types of thinking. Some people see they hate right-wingers because they see right-wingers as being for the rich and the corporations, but then there's also some people within, like, the academic elite and the media elite, they sort of associate being right-wing with being, like, a trailer trash. So I think there's two ways of thinking about that.
I think there's numerous sides to the right wing. I mean, it's a very interesting adventure to just explore it. I mean, you may remain left wing, you may remain anarchistic, whatever your thing is, but I really wish a lot of my left-lib friends would actually give themselves a chance to spend a year or two exploring those writers, exploring those thinkers.
Yeah.
You know, they're not all contemptible.
Well, that's
big surprise.
The weird thing is that, you know, when you're in these kind of you know, everyone's a free spirit, everyone's open-minded, and you don't, but it's not about kind of challenging yourself, because there's, like, this forbidden zone that you should never enter into.
Do not go there.
I think right-wing is sort of code word for anyone who's politically incorrect or anti-establishment. I mean, I took those political compass tests that they put out there, and
oh, how did you do on those?
I got, like, centrist.
I don't know whether you should brag about that or not, Robert.
So I'm very moderate. I'm a very moderate, non-extreme offensive person.
Well, I think all of us kind of are, but because of the current, like, social climate, having the kind of, like, I don't know, sometimes a friend and I get in kind of, like, Nietzschean ways of thinking about this, like, current paradigm, where it's like, if you're a kind of person who chooses not to deny themselves, you're basically right wing. You know, like, if you're,
isn't it bizarre? Yeah.
If you're, like, a white dude, I mean, and who chooses to not deny himself, you know, and chooses
Well, again, you know, old fart moment. The funny thing is, for somebody of my generation, I'm sort of a middle era boomer. I'm not an early era Woodstock boomer. I'm sort of a middle era boomer. You associated having a good time, you know, partying, trying things out, taking drugs, playing with extreme ideas, reading erotic comics, stuff like that. All that stuff was left-wing at the time, in 1972, 1974, 1968. All that stuff was left-wing. These days, I mean, they're anti all that stuff. It's bizarre. The exact same crowd, you know, with the colored hair and the you know, the self-righteous attitudes.
Well,
they're
that's what
no
I mean
fun
about,
whatsoever.
That's what I mean about the kind of dilettante angle or the aesthete angle. Is that it's like, you know, that you can buy a costume now. Because I'm
sure there was
a time in, like, you know...
what do you guys call it? You call it LARPing or something
LARPing,
like that.
LARPing, yeah, like live action role-playing.
Right.
Like, I'm
sure that's a great term.
I'm sure there was a time in the mid-50s or even, like, the 40s, you know, like, if, like, you know, like Maya Deren and people like that. And you know, Harry Smith, like, people like that, they were taking risks to sort of be the way that they were.
Oh, such a different world, and I'm so glad to hear you using those names.
Yeah.
Say, wow, it lives on. That's
great. Definitely. I mean, definitely. And because when you look at these people, you know, you see allegories. Like, I remember watching, like, that the one from 1944, like, At Land, where she's on the beach and she's playing chess.
And this is who, Maya Deren? Or
Maya Deren, yeah. And then there's this one part where she kind of like comes out of like the table at a party, and like this is 1944, and the people at the party, you know, it's sort of like there's some like it's kind of like multi-racial. People are sort of they're like, you know, the women are kind of maybe some women are like masculine, some men are like feminine. It's sort of like that kind of weird like left wing reality. Right. Not that that's
how
weird.
Radical can you be?
Exactly.
The thing is, like, originally it was kind of like the hippie mantra is like do what feels good or live and let live.
Well, what I'm saying
now, there's sort of their mentality of a lot of these SJW types, and one time they celebrate a lot of these. The things like they're like the transgender movement, but at the same time, there's something kind of a very like neo-puritanical about it.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. No, that's absolutely true. Yeah. Can I share another old fart observation with you? I think a lot of the stuff, I think the avant-garde, Maya Deren, Harry Smith, people like that from that era, a lot of what they were contending with was the limitations of technology at their time.
Oh, like Man Ray. Are you familiar?
You couldn't read an article and click on a link. I mean, that just wasn't possible at that point. You could making an avant-garde 15-minute film using 16-millimeter film was a hell of a lot of trouble, and it was expensive. Well, these days, all this stuff is instantly available to everybody. So in a lot of ways, the avant-garde just dissolves.
But look at like
the avant-garde utopia has arrived. We're living it now.
You know, if Stan Brakhage had to paint every single, piece of film, and someone like Bruce Bailey was that, you know, something of the Tears of the Dakota Sioux.
I love hearing these names.
These films are like there's a physical element to them. It's like physical art. It's like painting because someone had to make it with
their hands. And there was a lot of labor involved. Yeah. A lot of labor.
Yeah, and it seems that in like, you know, the digital realm, you can't do that with your hands. So you kind of have to do it with your ideas. And I think
becomes much more conceptual. You know, you import your video footage into Final Cut. You can do anything with it. Anything. And you just click on a button, and you've accomplished what it took Stan Brakhage a year to do. It's just astonishing.
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways, you know, what used to be – do you guys know a guy named Chris Marker?
He's the guy who made Sans Soleil and
Legete. Exactly, yeah. No, glad to hear that you know his name. Robert, you should investigate this guy. Two of his movies that you might want to explore, one is Sans Soleil – and the other one is The Last Bolshevik. He was of the age of the French New Wave, although he wasn't really part of the French New Wave. And he was such a born avant-gardist. He made film essays long before other people were making film essays. Very personal, wanted to use film as though it was a pen, and he was writing actual written essays, very personal, all that stuff.
It seems
and
like
he lived to be about 90 years old, and he actually saw the digital world come on. And in Sans Soleil and in The Last Bolshevik, he's sitting there going, oh my God, you know, all this stuff that in 1958 I wanted so badly to happen, it's here. We actually have it now. What is this going to do to the art form that I loved and the art form that I contributed to?
Well, about
fabulous stuff.
Chris Marker, it's sort of like he and like I feel like Chris Marker and like Agnes Varda, they're sort of like the sort of part of the school of the French New Right, but they kind of like a French New Right guy.
But they
French,
were left.
French New Wave.
They were
the French
left.
New
they
Wave.
Were left at the time.
But they were. You know? But you had like Godard and Truffaut and people like that who were kind of like the mainstream. And then like look at how through Godard's career, he just sort of like dismantled himself and now is making things that are just like, you know, he's taking a little digital recorder and like filming a girl talking near a boat, and it's like it's almost like they've gotten out of touch or something, you know.
They become irrelevant, and Godard, as I understand it these days, he's like worried about how he's going to pay the bills.
Yeah.
Godard is in his 80s now. I remember reading something recently about how he was doing his best to land a position on a French college, and he said, "You know, I'm in my 80s. I could get sick. I don't have insurance. I don't know how I'm going." This is Godard. You know, this is like the uber revolutionary of 1965. He's now basically sitting there going, "How do I pay my bills?" But he's still making crazy, extreme movies.
I want to get your thoughts on the sort of dynamics of how tastes are formed and what is considered good taste and a bad taste.
Oh, such
for a lot of people.
Have you got 5 or 6 hours?
For a lot of people in the cultural elite and wealthy donors, how do they form their taste? Do they just sort of go along with what is perceived as good taste, as rather, because a lot of people just assume these people have the most influenced or the most money, they must have like the highest aesthetic standards.
You've got about 7 different rants suddenly buzzing in my brain. Let me share short versions of maybe 2 of them with you. Robert knows Santa Barbara really well. My wife and I are currently living in a small apartment in Montecito, which is the most upscale part of Santa Barbara. A really fascinating thing about Montecito is the uniformity of taste here. It's really a very beautiful part of the world. People have money, you know, they can indulge their taste. The funny thing about it is that there's a kind of consensus taste. I've got a BMW, I've got a Land Rover, they're all white or gray or black. They're doing what other people of their particular class and at their particular level do.
There's a cultural hegemony.
With Montecito, exactly. Is it still very kind of an old wealth, or is there a strong sort of a Hollywood influence, or it's a combination of both?
Oh, so interesting. We, Polly and I, my wife and I, know some old Montecito people. They're sort of, you know, shabby chic. There's money there. Montecito was created by people from the Northeast coming out for the good weather, people with money. But recently, and I asked a couple of old Montecito friends, I said to them, well, what changed and when did it change? And they said like 65 to 75, something like that. All of a sudden there was like Hollywood money coming out. There was new money coming out. There's still an old Montecito world out here, which is very, very shabby chic and surprisingly unpretentious. But there's a lot of new money, show business, finance, stuff like that. That's
the managerial class.
Sorry. I'm sorry?
The managerial class.
The managerial class, exactly. One of the things that fascinates Polly and me the most about living in Montecito is that the food in Montecito is very expensive and pretty good, but not all that good. And we look at each other and we say, well, these people, they've got all the money in the world. They can eat anything they want. Why are they settling for this? The only theory we come up with is because other people like them are eating this stuff.
Well, I
so they're doing what other people like them do.
Obviously, there's sort of a concept of the elite, but even there's also kind of local areas. Rich people in those areas have their own standards. Montecito obviously has a very different culture than, say, the Hamptons, Beverly Hills, or a place like Palo Alto.
Sort of similar, sort of different, sure, yeah. Well, I think here's a question for you guys, and I would love to hear what your answer is. Why are so many cities around the world letting Frank Gehry build a building in their city?
Because it's a status symbol for that city.
It's a tough one to answer. My answer to that, and I think my major contribution to the cultural conversation, is because other places like them are doing it. So
that's globalization. And that's a cultural hegemony coming from globalization, I think.
I would drag it down even to a more basic level than that. And I would say that it basically boils down to other people like the person I imagine myself to do are doing this.
Ah.
So I'm doing it too.
Well, you know what's funny? Is like if you look at these kind of, you know, these rich people, these like new class, that's what Peter Brimelow was calling them, new, like the new class.
Isn't he a great figure?
Oh,
I love
Brimelow. We had him on the show. But
you did?
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah,
I missed that.
Really nice guy. But, you know, these new class types, if you look at just, you know, like you said before, how much money they have and the way that they dress. Now, I know that this is kind of a silly topic, but it's
No, it's not silly at all. I think it's a very telling
when
topic.
When you look at the, you know, sort of rich people or you know, the way everyone sort of carried themselves in the I mean, things were just, I guess, made on a smaller level. Your tailor made your pants or something, so they weren't mass produced. So I guess that's why they probably fit better back in the 20s or something. But I don't think people necessarily had better taste. I think clothes probably just were more made for them. But, you know, it's just so funny that the people who are, you know, these rich people just have terrible taste and just sort of copy one another. but they don't even have a sense that, you know, this kind of, they're spending, you know, $150 on like a polo from
150. What are you talking about?
Oh, well, I'm just saying like they'll buy like an Under Armour polo.
Yeah, no,
new from, yeah. You know, it's like, because they can go to, you know,
they do not have actual real personal taste,
yes,
in the way that,
the
say,
thing.
The three of us have.
Yeah, well, they could, you know,
the
they
three
can
of
get
us
like a,
have quirky personal taste, strong reactions to things. They look at other people like themselves, and they either want it or they make their own decisions in relation to that.
But
that restaurant, have that food, wear that sweater, go to that jewelry maker. And these are the people who, in many cases, run culture.
And the thing about the three of us is I'm sure we have disagreements about cultural and aesthetic standards among ourselves.
Right, but who cares, right? It's fun. It's fun to compare notes, and it's fun to learn.
It's okay to disagree, but the problem is people going along with it. And I also think part of the problem is that most people are not creative. Most people are not passionate about things like art and architecture. They kind of want to be somewhere that's pleasant, but the number of people, we kind of talked about this in our last show, it's a very small kind of a niche.
You mean people who have very strong reactions to these questions?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
People
will
go on vacation, like they'll go on vacation to these different cities like Europe, London, Paris, New York, San Francisco, and they can appreciate it. But
and then they don't apply it to their own lives. They don't go back to their suburbs and think, well, why isn't this where I live more like Paris? Or why isn't it like that small town in Spain that I love so much? You know, it's a perfectly worthwhile question. It's a genuinely good question. But, you know, they don't actually ask it. It's very bizarre.
I mean, they speak a language that's a grammar of, like, self-intolerance. You know, these people, like, they sort of, like, they're kind of just in a nihilistic void of, like, this is just the way things are. When I want to have a good time, that's when I want. When I go on vacation, that's when I have a good time. The rest of the time, I just go to work.
Isn't it an interesting psychological study that they do that, and they're able to do that? I mean, I really
are they?
Sometimes
I mean,
want to grab them by
the
collar and say, "Look, you went to Charleston, you went to Rome, you went to, you know, wherever. You went to Split, Croatia. What did you love about it? And why isn't that in your hometown? Why isn't something similar present in your hometown?"
One thing I've noticed about here in Santa Barbara. Is Santa Barbara is a city that was kind of modeled after Spain. And
why aren't more places in America as pleasant as Santa Barbara? I mean, Santa Barbara has a very blessed physical setting. It has a very blessed climatic setting. But a lot of what's very pleasant about life in Santa Barbara could transfer easily over to Cleveland or New York City or Albany or Memphis or something like that. And it doesn't.
Yeah.
Why not?
I saw a post from Kurt Doolittle on Facebook earlier today, and
he said,
you know, I'm living in a, you know, I've lived in all these, I would much rather like live in, like slum it here in Ukraine, whatever word he used, like, you know, it wasn't the best thing. I'd rather be here.
He's over in the Ukraine,
he's
is
in
that
Kiev.
Right?
He's in Kiev.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, I still say the Ukraine instead of just Ukraine.
Well, he's there.
He's saying,
I would much rather be here than in the situation I am than be in a good situation in like New York or LA, something like that. And he goes, why? Because of the culture. So
it still blows people's minds. I mean, it's really fun. I mean, this is another old fart moment for me, but it used to be a thing that if you were a college kid, you would spend a year overseas. You'd go to Barcelona, you'd go to Paris, you'd go to Rome, something like that. And it would change your life. You suddenly would understand that the quality of life, food, having an affair, culture, going to a museum, that these were life-transforming experiences. I'm not sure it's at all the case for you guys or for your generation.
No,
but
there are ways for people to show off on Instagram.
Well,
ways for people to show off. That's
I think in a way it can be a changing experience. But then I also think that you come back to a cultural hegemony, you know. So you kind of you can't. It's hard for people to be weird. It's hard for people to be not of the flock. I think people fear losing. You know, the people around, I mean, it's like, because we're only meant to, what is that, Godwin's law? We're only meant to have 100 friends, you know, and we're all connected to all these people through the internet. So it's just much easier just to go with everyone else than to put up a fuss and morph into something different. So maybe
I noticed one trend in culture is that there is kind of this cultural stagnation. So people are looking to the past for inspiration.
Are they really? You mean you're thinking of stuff like steampunk or?
We just did a whole show about that, about retrofuturism, and a lot of it's just...
That's your thing, sure, yeah.
A lot of it is just kind of these, like, online subcultures, like steampunk, cyberpunk, and vaporwave, mid-century, space-age aesthetics.
Good Lord, what's vaporwave? I know nothing about that.
Well, it's like,
Explain that in one sentence or less.
So there was a record that was released in 2012 by this group called Macintosh Plus. And there were a couple of things like that around the time, but it's really funny because it's a genre of music. But and there's a couple other groups, like there's like Saint Pepsi, I think people would say is vaporwave, and the aesthetics are just like, you know, images of like a bust of like Cicero floating and like weird like casino graphics. And that's then, like, you know, kind of like elevator music mixed with, like, you know, like synthesizer beats and all this kind of stuff.
But I love that.
The funny, the thing is, it's really a genre of music, but it's like one song. There's just kind of like,
yeah, but it's like I'm writing down vaporwave.
Well,
that's
I think I could probably actually play it because of the, like, it's just this, like,
I'm not hearing it really well, but that's very 1920s to me, isn't it?
I'll have to send you a link later.
Oh, what do you mean? Like, sort of has like a little like putting on the Ritz kind of feeling to
it. Oh, yeah, yeah, very. That's a terrific image. Here's another old fart.
You mean the 80s putting on the Ritz or the original?
Probably both. That's what retrofuturism is.
Here's another funny old fart moment for you. I remember, I forget when it was. It was like 2005 or 2008 or something. My wife and I wrote a script and co-produced an early web series with a friend of ours who was a young guy.
Sex Scenes.
Sex Scenes was our audiobook. Our web series was called The Fold. Matt Lambert was our wonderful, young, talented filmmaker. He's out here at this point in L.A. working in reality TV and doing all kinds of great things. Anyway, it was great. And Matt, I mean, super cool guy, super young, super tuned into everything. We interacted a lot with the neo-burlesque scene. I mean, it was very downtown. It was very exciting. It was very cool. Matt was into metal music. And I confess that I found myself thinking, you know, in 1978, in 1980, when I was in the punk rock scene in New York City in the East Village, and I was kind of a hanger-on, I was not, like, in the thick of it, but I was there nonetheless, the people who listened to metal were fucking idiots. Yeah. If you were a smart kid with some arty interests and a little bit of a brain, you were into punk. And if you were, you know, a drunken working-class idiot, you were into metal. And no disrespect meant, I mean, really genuinely, I grew up with a lot of kids who were into metal, but I never paid attention to it. It just wasn't my thing. And all of a sudden, here was this smart guy, smart, talented, arty guy from NYU, who I was working with on a web series. He was into metal. He actually had a metal band that he played with in the East Village. When did metal become cool? When did metal become an okay thing for hip, smart kids to enjoy?
I always associate metal more with like the late 80s.
Well, Robert, there's different kinds of like metal music, you know.
Isn't that great?
Well, you're thinking of like hair metal, but I think what happened is metal became like a subversive thing. Like you had Nirvana effectively like killed metal in the mainstream. You know, all the kids stopped wanting to like be like Tommy Lee and started wanting to be like Billy Corgan. You know, and then like, you know, things sort of like evolved from there, at least for like, people that are like, you know, quote unquote, like alternative people.
Right, alternative,
yeah. But I think what happened was you had like metal, you know, became this like bloated dinosaur, you know, it's like, you know, Metallica was like, you know, like doing covers albums, you know, like in 1995, they did a covers album. So like, I mean, they weren't doing Frank Sinatra.
I take my daily walk these days on the Santa Barbara Beach, I'm listening to Metallica because I did not listen to Metallica the first time. And I have young, cool, creative friends.
It became
who
subversive.
Metallica's great.
It became
it's time for me
subversive. I think it became something that that was like, you know, like you said about the right wing, that was like, you know, like this is the most disgusting thing ever. So I think Robert and I have
talked about this, but a lot of the buzz that was in, do you guys remember the term the yippies?
Oh, the sort of like yuppie.
Ben Abby Hoffman, they were like extremes.
Oh, yeah.
Extreme of the hippies in 1968.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
They were absurd. I mean, they did things like they went to the New York Stock Exchange with a bag full of $1 bills, and they just threw the bag of $1 bills over the floor in the New York Stock Exchange just for the hell of it. It was absurdist theater, essentially. And
a political theater.
Mind, a lot of that energy, a lot of the yippie energy from 1967-68 is in the alt-right today.
Yeah,
it's a precursor to the whole kind of a troll culture.
Yeah.
Like the original, like a Pepe meme.
Well, it's like giving the finger to the mainstream. And, yeah. And you know, where do you find that these days? It's in the alt-right, right? I mean, unless I'm completely tuned out of the culture.
No, I think
now Hillary Clinton's going to give a speech about the alt-right.
Well, isn't that great? I'm looking forward to that.
Well, have you guys seen Sam Hyde's new show on Adult Swim, World Peace?
No, what is that?
It's a show on Adult Swim, which is like, you know, Cartoon Network.
Right.
And it's like an alt-right show. Like, it's...
Oh, you're kidding, really?
It's like they had a song called... they had a segment where Sam Hyde was jumping around with a bunch of like little kids and they were singing a song called Jews Rock. And this was like on Cartoon Network. And they're just like, Jews Rock, Jews Rock. And then they cut
so
to the, they cut to the producers. The producers on Adult Swim are just sitting there and like looking at the monitor, like just not even like understanding where they're at. You know, it's like, okay, another show we just got to film, and you just see this like old Jewish guy.
You
see these like old Jewish guys sitting there while they're just like, Jews Rock.
Well, rounding it all out, I mean, the last thing I looked at on Adult Swim was, I don't know, 5 years ago or something, and it was Metalocalypse. So I sat there going, oh my God, it's Scandinavian death metal.
Yeah, so it's like, yeah.
But it's a spoof of Scandinavian
also,
death metal.
Also, I know
metal.
On
brilliant.
Adult Swim, there's a show called Tim and Eric. If you've seen them, they're basically kind of
vaporwave. I think I've watched like one Tim and Eric, but it was years ago. I don't remember it very much.
Well,
it was brilliant, though.
The thing about Tim and Eric is like, you know, like you're saying about like the yippies, like there was this kind of like bizarre political theater on like the far left.
Exactly.
And I
yeah.
feel like, you know, people like Tim and Eric. And then now there's this guy, Eric Andre. Like, they sort of occupied that area. But the thing is, the left is not funny anymore. Like, there's nothing funny about the left. I mean, it's only making fun of it. You know, because it's, you can all, because this is the thing. Like, Jon Stewart was the jester mocking George Bush. And now.
And you could predict every single fucking joke he ever made.
But now.
I mean, did he ever come up with anything surprising?
No, but it's become even worse now because not only is Trevor Noah the jester in Obama's court, he's like the jester like hired by Obama's court, you know, it's just like
exactly,
it's like
yeah.
he's just oh going he doesn't even mock the president, he's
well the fact that people can't see this amazes me. I mean, in a funny way, if I'm to break my arm patting myself on the back, I feel like I still respond to people who get buzzy, irreverent, crazy, edgy things. And I will follow that around. I don't really care what
yeah,
the label
is. Yeah, you're tuned
is.
Into
will,
the zeitgeist.
But I have an amazing number of friends my own age who are, you know, stuck in 1975. And the meanings of 1975 are still relevant to them. They don't realize
well,
that 40 years have passed.
That's the
40
thing.
Years. I mean, that's two generations.
Yeah,
I see
you
that,
get
yeah.
kind of people who are, like, stuck on this, kind of stuck in this nostalgia. And these different, like, the generation gaps between different groups. Like, one thing I was kind of commenting on, I noticed with baby boomers is that they have, like, a strong...
Treat them respectfully, that's my group.
...nostalgia for the 60s, but
yeah.
when it comes to kind of the 80s, it's kind of a... It's
a different world. No, you're absolutely right about
people
that.
People like to kind of make fun of the 80s, like... Wasn't it James O'Meara who had that thing? People say, oh, that's so 80s.
That's so 80s.
Yeah, but it's, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, me and my friend were listening to Tears for Fears the other day, The Shout by Tears for Fears. And I was thinking, like, this song is actually amazing. You know, like the production is really interesting. Like, it's aged. There's this, it's enough time has gone by.
When did
by.
It come out? What's
like
the year on that song?
1984.
Okay.
And you can, I feel like enough time has gone by that you can go back and you can appreciate something like Simple Minds or Tears for Fears. And it's like aged really well. There's the interesting quality that it has, because even this music is in a way somewhat subversive, you know, because there is a kind of idea that like the mainstream pushes forward, you know, there's just like,
For sure. I mean, you've got like six different rants triggering off in me at this point. It's an interesting thing to observe as the years go by is like what lives and what doesn't live.
Or what's reborn.
What's reborn? What's relevant to the present moment? What resonates to people now? And in 5 years and maybe in 50 years, it's you know, you can't predict this. The funny thing, Robert and I were talking about this at one point, about the era of the great intellectual, the great critic, was that they would pat themselves on the back for waving a little magic wand and saying, this is significant, that's not significant. And if you went back into their record, they were wrong most of the time. I mean, a lot of stuff that is still relevant today, that still resonates today, Tears for Fears, for example, nobody at the time thought it was going to last 30 or 40 years. Nobody.
Yeah. Well,
absolutely,
that's the thing.
Nobody.
Like, you know,
so
look
why do we pay attention to gatekeepers at all?
Well, that's
see that with like musicians and artists. Like originally, Van Gogh was considered, in his time, he had no respect as an artist. And I know when the Eiffel Tower was first built, in the 19th century, it was considered an eyesore. So that's always, sometimes it takes time for people to appreciate things.
You know, and it could be in 30 years that people will hate Van Gogh. And it could be that in 50 years, people will think that they, once again, think that the Eiffel Tower is an eyesore.
But
we don't know.
But
you know,
the
this
thing
is all predicting the future.
But the thing
predicting
is,
the future is a fool's game.
About gatekeepers, it's like, you know, in 1973, no one was writing about Big Star, you know? Like, the people at Rolling Stone did not write about Big Star. And then even, like, you know, Burt Jansch or, like, Karen Dalton and these kind of people have a, you know, millennials view them. Like, they don't listen to, you know, a lot of millennials, like, don't even know a Joni Mitchell song, but they know all the Karen Dalton music. They know Karen Dalton, you know, because there's this kind of, like, world of, like, you know, like, Tumblr music and, like, YouTube music that people just share. And, you know, like, the canon changes. Like, a new canon is
formed. Boring old person perspective. The 1970s are, I mean, as far as movies go, they're currently considered, like, one of the peaks of American movies. Sam Peckinpah, Francis Coppola, Martin Scorsese, Robert Altman, all that stuff. Most of that stuff in the 1970s, which is when I got super interested in movies, most of that stuff bombed. Most of that stuff not seen by very many people.
But didn't a lot of people go see The Godfather and The Conversation? Like, I thought that was like what people went to see.
The Godfather was a huge hit. The Conversation was a bomb.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. Robert Altman had one hit. His hit was MASH. His movies like McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which are now legendary.
I have a poster of that movie
McCabe
on my
Mrs.
wall.
McCabe and Mrs. Miller is on Criterion. You know, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, nobody went to see. Nobody went to see. It's my favorite movie of all time.
Well, I have a poster of it on my wall.
Yeah, no, it's one of the great movies.
Yeah, but
it's unbelievably great.
But millennials...
But at the time, people mocked it. It was a huge bomb. A huge bomb.
Millennials that are kind of like clued into things know that movie. It's weird. I think, you know, the Criterion Collection... I don't know if McCabe and Mrs. Miller is on Criterion Collection, but I'm just being super spurgy
it
right there.
Be, yeah,
it should
thought,
be, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, millennials know Terrence Malick, you know, the ones who are into – and I think that that's really cool. Like,
there weren't many people who went to see Terrence Malick movies.
But that's what it's wonderful that, you know, we've been able to, like, salvage our good art and present that to everyone, and everyone is not watching, you know, I don't –
But it may also mean that in 30 years – the version of quote unquote the 1970s that people have will be different than the one that we currently have. It's very satisfying for me right now that people love the 70s movies that I loved in the 1970s, but there's no guarantee in 10 years that they will love those same movies. Well, it's quite possible that in 5 years somebody's going to come along. There were an amazing number of square movies made in the 1970s that were big hits. And it's possible
that example?
10 years, people
like
are going to go
story?
Back and they're going to say, those were the great movies of the 1970s.
Like, are you saying like Love Story?
Yeah, like, Love Story.
Like, what are the worst?
The Towering Inferno.
Oh, God, yeah. Never mind.
Oh, yeah. Terrible stuff. I mean, to me, terrible stuff. But
well, that's the thing.
It's like, possible people are going to go back and say, you know, that was great.
Well, you know what's funny? I feel like a film like Death Wish, like, you know, that's a kind of like a bit of a schlocky movie, you know.
Death Wish is an awesome movie. Yes, you're absolutely right.
It's
a schlocky movie.
Though.
It's an awesome movie.
But I feel like the thing is, it's awesome because it's like subversive. You know, because Taxi Driver is a masterpiece to me, you know.
Sure. I can't argue with that.
You know, it's this kind of like Nietzschean idea. It's all, you know, it really, it's like, you know, this like, there's like the element of like this guy sort of like lost in like an eternal wilderness, you know, like he's like a Vietnam vet and now he's lost in like the jungle of like the city and he's like.
And I think even more generally than that, anybody who's ever been alienated and an underground man can relate to it, right?
Exactly. And sort of like the will to power to sort of lift oneself up. And that's the thing. And the thing is, you don't see there, you can't really make that argument from like Death Wish. I don't think that the substance is there, like in sense of like the story. I mean,
on the other hand, something like Death Wish is represent. I mean, along with Dirty Harry, along with Falling Down, that Michael.
Movie,
that was a great film.
I mean, these are movies that were despised by critics. Despised by critics.
Well, you know why?
And yet they live.
What's interesting
they live.
About those films is they all capture a city in an era.
They sure do.
I know that. Taxi Driver is New York in the 70s.
It's like a documentary of New York in the 70s.
Dirty Harry is San Francisco in the 70s, and
absolutely.
Then Falling Down captures L.A. in the early 90s, which that's like kind of my earliest memory,
well,
so
you
that's
know,
the film.
You know why those movies get bad reviews is because they represent like a hero, like it's a heroic view of the authoritarian like personality.
You guys are going to have to bring me up to date, but it used to be thought that if you were an arty guy, you were a left-winger. And if you were cheering a movie or you were cheering a work of art, it was partly because it was a left-wing thing.
Mm.
Is this still true? I have no idea.
Well, I'll tell you right now why that's true. That's completely true. Robert brought up Tim and Eric before. And then there's this guy, Eric Andre, who's of that kind of variety. And someone asked him if he liked Guns N' Roses, like on some podcast or something, and he goes, "Oh, I hate that band. They're racist assholes because they have that one song. They have that one song that's sort of like, you know, he's like immigrants and faggots mean nothing to me." And he's like, but dude, that song is fucking hilarious. And I would think that like a guy who's like a comedian like would be able to like appreciate it. And the thing is.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And the thing is like people say, "Oh, but he's offended by it because he's like." He's like Haitian and like Jewish. But the thing is like, I'm like, my dad is Jewish. My mother's not Jewish. But like, I can like laugh at every single one of those like Jew.jpg and my man images of Jews I think are hilarious.
Should artsy people be concerned about the political point of view that much at all?
I don't think so.
Freewheeling. We should be free of political concern. We shouldn't worry so much about party line crapola. We should be able to sit there going, you know, that works.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's sexy. That's incredible.
Oh,
we
that's
be
the
reacting
thing.
In
there's
that
no
way without having any political filter.
But if you look at women from like the late, from like the early 2000s, someone like, you know, Asia Argento, you know, completely beautiful woman.
Total psycho talented.
Well, yeah, like, or Monica Bellucci, you know, you just don't really see like this kind of beauty.
We don't have to politicize everything. We don't.
But we politicize beauty, you know, and I like people like Gaspar Noé who still make movies with like, you know, like Paz de la Huerta and Enter the Void. It's like there's this kind of like experience that you can, I mean, because that's the thing. It's like, you know, no matter what your sexual orientation is, you can watch these films and sort of like have these kind of like bizarre psychosexual experiences with them that do change your life.
Is not completely bound up by politics.
Ray Sawhill, I'd like to thank you for being on the show.
Thanks again, Robert, for having me. It's always a lot of fun.